And welcome back once again to How to Survive 2025. I'm Brian Keene.
I'm Daisha M. Arnold.
I am Jim Cobb, and joining us this week is a special guest. We have Craig Caudill. He is the director of Nature Reliance School down in Kentucky. Welcome to the show, Craig. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here, you all. Thank you so much for letting me be here.
Awesome.
We wanted to do a show. We've had requests from listeners and viewers to do a show about active shooters and other mass casualty events, things like that. And while I can speak somewhat intelligently on that topic, you can speak way more intelligently on that topic. Can you share with our viewers and our listeners a little bit of your background as related to this kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for asking. So I'm the director of Nature Reliance School here in Kentucky, where we teach primarily wilderness skills, survival, land navigation, man tracking, and stuff along those lines. Prior to that, I taught combatives and martial arts for almost 20 years as a profession. And one of the things that I did is I trained a lot of law enforcement officers, and a lot of what I did was I would trade skills for skills. So I would train physical skills and they would train me in various things, including physical skills. But a lot of it was I got involved heavily in both on the, I guess, the local level starting, and then eventually state and federal level and training law enforcement and various things. And that led, you know, a couple decades ago to a real heavy focus on preventative means of avoiding, you know, hand-to-hand conflict, whether it's armed or unarmed, because the best way to win a fight is to not be in a fight altogether. That's my opinion on it. And that led to being trained in by various agencies on basically pre-event, what I call pre-event indicators for active shooter. What kind of things can we do to recognize an active shooter event is about to occur? What can we do to prevent that from happening before it actually starts? And then eventually, you know, it went into assisting other instructors in leading programs on active shooter response. I know my lane. I don't try to pretend to be something I'm not. I'm not an operator. I've never been in the military, never been in law enforcement. But I like to study how people interact and go about their day in the world, whether that's average ordinary people or up to including an active shooter. And so trying to train my folks in hand-to-hand, you know, hand-to-hand is a sexy word, but just self-defense really more than anything, but trying to train my folks to be adequately prepared to avoid as many fights as possible led to a pretty in-depth study of, you know, some of the things that we can also see in active shooter events prior to them happening. You know, how do we read people? How do we read places? How do we enhance our situational awareness? How do we set ourselves up for success and all the things that go along with it?
Let's start there. We've talked on the show at length in past episodes about situational awareness, mm-hmm. You know, what to look for when you're in a public setting, a movie theater, a concert, school, things like that, identifying your exits and alternative exits. How do you identify that, you know, a mass casualty event is about to take place, that there's a bad actor amongst you who intends harm?
Man, that's a tough question to answer, and I'm going to dig into it because there is so much to that question that you just asked, and I think I'd like to start at the ground level, if that's okay, and basically try to get at the heart of what it is that situational awareness is. I'm not saying that what I have is any particular better insight or worse than what you all have already shared, because I haven't listened to all your all's podcasts. I've listened to some of them. You are doing a great job, by the way. Great job. I think a big thing that comes out of this is how we assess our attention when we're looking for things. And a big part of this that I think is missing is what is commonly referred to in a lot of circles as sense making. How do you make sense of what it is that you're seeing? And I think that's the ground floor of what it is that we need to understand as far as it relates to situational awareness. And this might be something you all have already said in the past, but let's throw a couple of different clothes on it and see if I say something that looks a little different and maybe it'll resound somebody. You know, I think the first level is perception. when we're talking about situational awareness, how do we detect these key elements, which I think goes right back to your question, Brian. How do we detect the people, the what kind of events do these kind of events of things happen at? Is it at a country music concert? Is it a rock concert? Is it an open venue? What kind of events do these things happen? For example, just a quick indicator is that there's been a lot of these that have been happening at open field type music events as of late, more so than people like to recognize, my daughter being one of them, because she loves going to those things and I would rather her never go to another one.
Greg, I have a quick question. You keep saying when we are looking, when we see or we recognize these signs. So when you say we in a we sense, is it like the royal we, or is it like everyday people? Everyday people.
Yeah. Okay. That's who I'm speaking to. I'm speaking to us, the people that are listening that are everyday people. I think the things that I'm going to share really aren't incredibly technical. And a lot of the things that we're going to discuss are things that people are already doing. I'm just going to give you a little insight that you're doing them without realizing them. Wow. So that you can do what I just mentioned, which is make sense of what it is that you're picking up. There's a lot to how our eyes pick up things compared to how that gets processed in the brain. And what we know is that every single one of us that are here on this podcast or listening to it, see these things that we're getting ready to talk about, but the processing of it, the sense making of it is the key component. Your typical law enforcement officer, highly trained individuals in observational awareness, situational awareness, and looking at these sort of things, they're on all the time and recognizing these things. The typical person is not. That's why a lot of times we talk about Cooper's color code of awareness, and most people are walking around in code white. I'm sure you all probably talked about Cooper's color code. We, meaning, Daisha, to go back to your original question, we as the average ordinary person need to be walking around in code yellow all the time. We need to be aware of what's going on. We're not concerned. There is no threat, but we are paying attention to our surroundings. And so I think that goes to, I hope that answers your question, Daisha.
No, it does. Who we is. Really, but we haven't gone through the Cooper's.
Right. That's one thing we didn't touch on yet. You want to breeze through that real quick.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Because my therapist told me it's abnormal for me to walk around so yellow all the time. I disagree with her on that.
Okay, I would too. We could probably talk about Cooper's color code for a whole hour too, but let me dig into it real quick. So, Jeff Cooper was a fantastic, for lack of a better way of saying, a tactical strategist, and he did extensive study and research and instruction and writing on tactical awareness and a lot of other things too, shooting and all the things that go along with it. And he came up with this color code of awareness going from, and there's a lot of different variations and people have added to it at this point, but white is where most people are walking aware, unaware, and very vulnerable to anything that's going on around them. Yellow, code yellow is next, which is where you have general alertness and you're aware of your surroundings, meaning you're paying attention to your surroundings. Code orange is where you have focused attention on a specific threat. That's where you see, hey, somebody has the imprint of a firearm and they're not supposed to have a firearm where we're located, or they're wearing that long coat that we've seen in some of these active shooters events. And that just, you know, somebody wearing a long coat in a venue where it's 95 degrees outside, that's a threat. There's something going on there. That doesn't mean that we immediately, what I like to say, we don't thump them immediately. We don't put the hammer down on them. We don't physically or metaphorically even, but we do have attention on that person to see if they are a threat. Code red is where we know there is a threat and we're prepared to take action. We're going to do something about it. And then code black even takes it a little bit step further. And I think this is a little bit beyond what Cooper talked about, but we should discuss it, is that where you have mental and physical overload. There's so much going on in our heads. This is typically reserved for people on a battlefield. People on the battlefield that have been educated on these sorts of things, but there's so much going on in the battlefield and there's so many threats, there's too much to take in. So that would be a real general understanding of Cooper's color codes, as I understand it. If, you know, I'm sure your listeners will let us know in comments if they're allowed, if there's anything they would like to add to it.
Absolutely. Yep. No worries. What you've shared meshes exactly with my understanding.
Okay, good.
Color code. Now, interesting little side note or anecdote or however you want to look at it. I spent several years working in retail security when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we did, obviously, was watching for shoplifters. Mm-hmm. And this was way before I knew anything about Cooper's color code. Okay, I didn't know it existed. But I developed the same type of steps when it came to observing the sales floor.
Now, did you figure that out on your own, Jim, or did somebody train you in that? That's fantastic. No. Well, I mean, that's awesome.
There was some training involved with like what you look for, you know, are some of the alert signals, things like that. But one of the things that I kind of figured out on my own was how this kind of ramps up. You know, you walk around in code yellow, you walk around, you're alert to other shoppers, you're alert to employees, you're alert to what's going on, but you're not honing in on any one particular person. Then you observe somebody, say, look up at the camera, or they start picking at a tag, or they start, you know, monkeying with the packaging. Well, okay, now you're in orange. You're okay, something's going on here that deserves my attention. We want to focus in and see what's happening. And then, for example, you would hear the sound of them removing one of the electronic tags from a CD. And it's a distinctive adhesive pulling away from plastic. And it's like, boom, that's code red. We know they're stealing. We know that they're intent. And it just, when I learned about Cooper's color code, it was like this giant light bulb went off in my head. I was like, I get it. And I didn't even know that. I got it. That's cool.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
What I just discovered. So what I just discovered, like having been deployed twice and then coming back home, is that like if I'm out and about, I'm at a yellow. If I hear a loud noise, I will go to red. There's no orange. Or I will go red real quick and then back to orange and be like, okay, nobody else is reacting.
It's not, I mean, we talk about this, what you're discussing. I do some work with Camp Hero out of Kentucky here, where we do.
I'm from Kentucky, so I'm really curious to
get out from where.
So my whole family's in Western Kentucky.
Oh, and nice. Then
I met my husband in Clarksville in the Army.
Okay.
But yeah, all my family's Western Kentucky.
Fantastic.
A little bit of Central, but mostly Western.
Well, Central Kentucky is the best place in the world to live, just so you know. It's great. Anyway, we do some work with Camp Hero here in Kentucky, where we do outdoor wilderness programming for people that have experienced trauma. I'm not saying you have. And one of the things that kept coming up in that is that those of us who've experienced really stressful events, it's easy for us to go from yellow to red because the amygdala is a little bit stretched, for lack of a better way of saying it. This is beyond my understanding and being able to communicate effectively. But once we have issues that have caused those stresses, then anything related to that stress at all can kick us back into.
It's that pattern recognition.
Yes. Yeah. Cause you're seeing that pattern, and then it takes you back to, even if you're not having some post-traumatic stress and issue.
Exactly.
It's just that you get stressed.
It's muscle memory.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
With circling back a little bit to the situational awareness aspect of all this, okay? The way I've always looked at it, and maybe this is not the correct way, but this is the way it's always worked for me, was situational awareness is what allows us to establish baselines. We have to pay attention to what's going on in the world. And as we pay attention, we develop like this pattern recognition, in a sense, we learn these baselines. You know, this is what I'm going to see every day. And it's the baselines, noticing those baselines, being observant of those baselines, is what allows us to recognize anomalies, which is where we kick it in to, say, code orange or whatever the case is. So I wanted to circle back a little bit and talk about the different levels of situational awareness and how one kind of leads to the next.
Yeah, sure. So I mentioned earlier, level one being perception. That's basically just detecting these key elements. Level two is what you're just discussing right now, which is understanding what those elements mean. And when you started talking about baseline inverse and anomalies, it really felt like you were flirting with me, Jim, because that's my that's my jam. That is my jam. So, you know, I teach a lot of man tracking. If I could teach man tracking every day of my life, I'd be tickled to death. I love it. And my understanding of tracking was where I first started understanding really what I feel like is have a better understanding of baseline versus what I call disturbance in tracking or anomalies. That is at level two level. Okay. Level two of situational awareness is baseline and anomalies, baseline versus disturbance or whatever. And then level three of situational awareness is where we want to be, right? Where we're starting to predict what is likely to happen based upon our understanding of those elements. So in a situational awareness, hey, we see that there is a person that is exhibiting or showing the tales of someone that is stressed. They've come in a door. And they're carrying something that looks heavy. We're starting to see these things. Now we have to predict what's likely to happen. And then we respond to it based upon that, basically what's referred to as projection. So the three levels are perception, comprehension, and projection. How do we handle ourselves in situational awareness? I hope that makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep.
Now, to go back to that, to continue to expand on it, is... Yeah. And Dacia, am I saying your name right, Dacia?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. So Dacia mentioned this earlier, and Jim just went into it a little bit more. There are big barriers to us having good situational awareness.
Mm-hmm.
The first is not monitoring the baseline. So, like, I've done some active shooter pre-event indicators for some various organizations here in Kentucky. And one of the most important people in the world to stopping active shooter is the person that's sitting at the front door, the greeter or the administrative assistant or whoever that sees everybody coming in the door. That person must be monitoring the baseline of the people that are coming in that door. The delivery drivers act a certain way. The people that are new and have no idea where they're going act a certain way. The people that are employees act another way. On and on and on. Each one of those people groups has a baseline of the way they behave. And that administrative assistant, that secretary, that whoever that person is at the front door, that greeter, is the one that is seeing them coming in the front, if they come in the front door, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they, being actively a person that is monitoring baseline, might be the best person to stop active shooter events. Mm-hmm. So that's one of three. Two is what I refer to as normalcy bias, which is most of us don't like, most humans as a species don't like change. We want things to be right. Normal. We want to have a pattern of behavior because when things change, we have to engage we have to burn calories. We have to think harder. We have to do all the things that go along with just living life. And we are biased to normalize most situations. For those of us who want to be, to not have a victim mindset, we have to regularly fight normalcy bias because it's rather natural for us. We've evolved to do that. We as a species have evolved to do that because, you know, the more activity we do, again, from a survival perspective, we have to burn these calories. So why not figure out how to do things so we don't have to burn as many calories? So number one, again, is not monitoring baseline. Number two is normalcy bias. And number three, which is the absolute worst in today's world, is what I refer to as focus lock. Focus lock is where we get so focused on something that we're not paying attention to our surroundings. And that is us on our phones, not paying attention to what's going on around us. So mm-hmm. the person that you see, and I saw this today at the gym, dude working out, got focus locked in some texting conversation, had no idea that people were just waiting for him to just get up and get out of the way. He had no idea, zero situational awareness. And as I say that, this is what I meant earlier when I said this to you all. We are seeing this every day right now.
Mm-hmm.
We see people every day that are on their phone in parking lots and have no ideas that cars are coming towards them. As I mentioned in the gym, you know, I'm guilty of it as a tracker. I can get focus locked on the ground, looking for tracks on the ground, and miss the, what we refer to as aerial sign up in the wood, you know, up in the trees. Okay. That's a real problem. So all of us, again, going back to Daisha's original question, all of us average ordinary people that are not tasked to being law enforcement or investigators mm-hmm. or whatever, we really have these three barriers to summarize: focus lock, not monitoring the baseline, and normalcy bias. And we've got to fight those all the time.
I think one fear a lot of people have is, or maybe it's just me, being in a situation and then being forced to be the hero. And I think everyone is terrified. Like, what if it's up to me and I can't do it? What if I'm the closest person and I don't make it? Like,
it's not you at all. And I think that comes to a moral or ethical understanding of how each of us have to engage in life. And, you know, we say this often, but a lot of warriors and law enforcement people are the people that run towards gunfire. And they are. I mean, their initial reaction is they hear gunfire, they go towards it. And so there should be, and I think we're going to talk about this a little bit later too, about the process of how we handle an active shooter of run, hide, fight, and what our thoughts are on that. But your typical person, when they hear gunfire, the normalcy bias is going to tell them that's firecrackers or a car backfiring. That's normalcy bias, because we want to normalize that. You know, one time I took a shooting course, a shoot, move, and communicate course, where the instructor put us down behind the berm and then shot over top of us so that we knew what it sounded like to hear gunfire on the business end of a firearm, because it sounds incredibly different than it does when you're on the backside of it and pulling the trigger. And that crack, that real sharp crack that people that are listening that know what I'm talking about, is unnerving when you hear it. And that means if, you know, fire, you know, gunfire is coming towards you. But most of us, even then, will want to discredit that in our minds due to this thing that we're referring to as normalcy bias and say, yeah, everything's okay. I don't know what that was, but it can't be that. I mean, I doubt there's very many places where people have been in an active shooter situation and immediately thought, oh, that's an active shooter.
Right.
Most of them want to discredit, at least subconsciously, because we don't want to be there. None of us want to be involved in that. So our minds say, let's go somewhere else in our mind. And that other thing is hearing a car backfire when it's actually a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wonder if we could speak to that real quick. I was very, very proud of my wife a couple weeks ago. You know, we live here in rural PA, but she grew up in suburban New Jersey. So for her first few years here, every bang she heard, that had to be fireworks. And I had to slowly explain to her, no, those are deer hunters. You know, that was a rifle, you know, that was fireworks. But the other day she correctly called it out. Somebody's shooting out back. Yep. Nice. There's hunters out back. Let's say you're at an open air concert and you hear that initial report. I know the answer, but are there telltale signs that, nope, that's gunfire, that's not fireworks?
It's going to have a severe crack if it's coming towards you. Most of us think of firearms going off as being a boom, because when we have heard them, we've been behind them and not in front of them.
Yeah.
And when we're in front of them, that bullet actually going through the air makes a cracking sound or a real sharp whipping sound. And it's not a boom really much at all. And so in that situation that you set us up in, the open air concert, that's when, as an individual, it's there. When you hear that first one and you see activity that indicates that somebody has been injured, you don't stand there any longer. You move. You move and you go somewhere now. Like, you move immediately. And that's not going to save everybody. It's just not, dependent upon the situation. But it's going to be harder. And I think we'll get into this in a minute. But there's a certain place that there's places you should go in an active shooter event. And it's not where everybody else is going. So right. We'll get into that a little bit later, I think.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, you arrive at the open air concert. Hopefully you had some situational awareness. You were at code yellow and you looked around and you identified some places like that, perhaps, that you can go to. But what should a listener be looking for in that type of situation? Like, you know,
we talk
about run, hide, fight, but where do they run to?
That's a great question. All your all's questions are good, by the way, but I wouldn't expect anything less from this crew. So I guess the big thing is, if we are herd animals too, as a species, humans are herd animals. And so we tend to go where the herd is going. And think of it as going into a Walmart. We're conditioned to go into a certain door and we go in that certain door. If and when something bad were to happen in that Walmart, we would come out that door. That would be our initial thought, would be to come out that door, because we're herd animals. And the reason from what's built into us perspective is that we came in that door and it was okay and it was safe. So we're going to initially think that going right back out that door, it is initially safe, when in fact that might be the funnel of death. If somebody is going to do something, they might be set up in that funnel waiting for people to do exactly that. So, you know, for example, my daughter bought us tickets to a concert a few years ago, and it's first time that she had been out with me. I've tried to train her when she's on her own, but with me, as soon as we walked in there, you know, everybody had to go to the floor through a certain two entrances. And I told her, I said, if something happens while we're here, grab a hold of my belt and hang on for dear life, because we're going somewhere else and I'm going to go through people to get there. And it's not going to be that exit that we just came in, because that's where everybody else is going to be going. So you mentioned it, Brian, but you would find those other exits, or even places where you run. That's where we try to exit. And when we can't run, we can't go anywhere because the people or the place is that's when we start to hide, or we go to a location where we're more likely to I don't know, be able to hide and at least not be seen. Or there's a difference between cover and concealment. You know, cover is where somebody's shooting and we can get behind something and we're okay. Concealment is where they can shoot through it, but at least we're not being seen.
That would be my first instinct, is to identify the closest barrier between the action and myself. I'm not going to use other people, but I'm going to run to the next hard area that is coverage. If you can't see me, I'm not here. And we joke when our kids play hide and seek, they close their eyes and say, you can't see me, I'm not here. But really, out of sight, out of mind, in an open air setting. There have been mass shooter instances where people have been barricaded so long that they didn't get help in time.
Yeah, that was a real serious issue when Israel was attacked in October. They pushed people into certain buildings and they just there was only one exit in and out, and the shooters went right through the same entrance that the people were basically in there and stuck and couldn't get out. And so they did what they did. But I think to your point, Daisha, is that, man, this is going to sound cruel, you know, my responsibility in that, let's just talk about that situation, because I think people understand it. In that situation that I was describing with me and my daughter, my responsibility is to me and my daughter and nobody else at that time.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get her and myself to safety. Now, if I respond to it in any other way, it's going to be after I have gotten her to safety. And that's just all there is to it. I don't care about other people at that point. And I'm not saying I would purposely grab people and use them as shields.
No.
But
I would use myself as a shield for my kid.
Oh, without a doubt I would. And I know if people are going through a certain exit and that's the funnel, I'm not going to the funnel. I mean, that's what would normally happen in that situation. I'm just not going there.
No. Well, and we've talked about this before, like I think just last week, when we talk about medical emergencies, you're responding to, you know, some sort of medical event and you have some training. The very first thing that you are taught is protect yourself first. Mm-hmm. Put on the gloves, put on the mask, you know, put on that type of stuff. Mm-hmm. And in an active shooter or something like that, I think the same principle applies. Protect yourself first. Get you and yours out of danger. And then if you feel it's appropriate, then respond. But you can't respond if you're dealing with multiple holes.
You know? Yeah, I mean, it's when we teach trauma medicine, stop the bleed or first aid or whatever, you know, the common saying is you're number one.
Yep.
And I think that's what you're alluding to here, Jim, is that I'm number one in that particular case and I've got to take care of mine and then I can possibly take care of others. And if I'm falling victim to the situation that's happening, then I definitely can't help other people.
Mm-hmm.
So let's do what we can. And it might even be that I have to get cover so that I can assess a situation, mm-hmm. even if I'm the type of person that might have to address it.
Yep.
So, I mean, I think all that stuff should be considered. And just me and my dudes in our regular discussion group where we talk about a lot of stuff like this, we were talking about this particular case right now that's happening where the Marine choked that dude out on the subway and now he's being prosecuted mm-hmm. for it. I mean, it's dependent upon where you are in the world. I think you have to take that, and I don't like saying this, but you have to take in consideration where you are and what kind of world that is on whether you might be prosecuted for engaging in it.
Were they not able to resuscitate him?
No, he killed the dude. Hopefully. I mean, the guy was threatening to kill people when this Marine grabbed him and choked him unconscious and killed him. And I don't know if he was active duty or not at the time. But now he is being prosecuted for involuntary manslaughter. Now, if he had done that in Kentucky, he wouldn't be.
Mm.
But where it's occurring, he is. And so mm-hmm. I think that we have to expand our awareness to that sort of thing and address these situations. For years, when I would teach self-defense, I'd say, hey, let's just, you take care of yours and take care of the people that you want to and let the law figure it out later. But more and more and more, I think I want to go back on what I used to tell my folks and think you have to consider that. I think you really do.
I think if it was me in that situation, I'd be charged with homicide with a deadly weapon. No,
you raise a great point. talk about firearms. Anytime I, you know, drive to New Jersey to visit the wife's family, you know, I double, triple check what's in the vehicle. What do I have? You know, make sure we leave all that behind because, you know, you get pulled over for something in New Jersey and you have that with you. The laws are very, very different.
Sure it is.
You know, speaking of firearms, so let's say we've run, we've hid, either we found concealment or we've found cover. But it doesn't matter. The perpetrator has discovered us. At that point, we have to fight. Now, we attended this open air concert without a concealed carry permit. We're not armed. You know, he's coming for us and our loved ones. Clearly he's still armed. What do we do, Craig? What does the listener do at that point?
It's not a good situation to be in at all, but the only chance you have against somebody that has a firearm when you do not have a firearm, which is the situation you've set us up in, is you must be close to that person. You've mm-hmm. got to get in close proximity enough to grab hold of the weapon and get it pointed in a direction where it can't bring harm to you or the other people around you.
Right.
That's the only chance you've got. And once you do that, once you get that firearm in a different direction, you have to do what I call cancel Christmas for that person. You need to lay hate on them as hard and as fast as you can go. Mm-hmm. And you should be, Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not saying if you're not trained that you can't do anything, but I'm saying you should be trained in how to do that. You should know how to inflict as much damage with surprise, speed, and balance of action as you possibly can in that situation to end it. And you've just got to turn at that particular time. Violence is the answer.
Yeah.
That is the answer to that problem. And again, it's like any other thing, like shooting a basketball, physical hand-to-hand combatives, shooting a firearm. You've got to train in those types of skills to be able to be effective at it. Oftentimes you can cause more problems if you don't have training.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying you should ignore it if you don't have any training, but this is what we have podcasts like this for. Mm-hmm. Is for me, as somebody you all have had on as guests, and I'm sure you all have said this before, because I don't know Brian and Dacia as well as I do Jim, but I know Jim well enough to know that he has told people to get trained. Yeah. Over and over and over again, get the training and whatever it is that we're talking about that you see as a need. Yep. And don't stick your head in the sand. What does that look like? That looks like somebody that teaches, you know, active shooter response, or an organization that teaches literal hand to hand against, you know, your unarmed and their armed situation. And if you're going to be the type of person that can respond with a firearm, you really have to train a lot. And I mean, just to give people a number, because people love numbers. If you're going to put $500 down on a firearm, you better put $1,500 into the training on how to use that firearm. Yes. And that it really should be a lot more than that. But at least for people that are new to this subject and hear me say that, they should have the realistic understanding that they're going to put a lot of money into quality training with quality instructors. And that is not a YouTube sensei. That's not where you get your training. You get it in person with somebody that has the experience to be able to share that with you. And again, that's what I was mentioning earlier. That's not me. I can't speak to that. That's not my lane, but you know, you find somebody that can do that sort of thing.
And I think it's important that viewers and listeners understand that when we talk about training, such as with firearms, we're not talking about just going to the range every other month and firing off 50 rounds at a paper target and going home. There's a lot more involved with it, because shooting at a range at a stationary target on a nice, clear, sunny afternoon is not how it's going to go down in real life, should you have the unfortunate circumstance of having to deal with a violent encounter. You know, your hand is going to be like this. You know, your heart's going to be going a million miles an hour. And it's important that you become familiar with those sensations and be able to overcome them and still react effectively. You know, Craig, I know you've used this phrase before. I know I've used this phrase before. You need to be hard to kill.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it starts, is with the training and understanding that you need that training. And seeking out competent instructors.
I've said this many times before on both on social media and just with our students at Nature Reliance School and elsewhere. Some of the most absolute dangerous people in the world that I know are also some of the nicest people I know, because they know what it's like to be in physical confrontation with people, and they don't want to engage in it unless they have to. So they'll talk their way out of it as much as they possibly can. We had a situation, we had a survival class this weekend, and one of the guys that attended class, he's on a special response team here in Kentucky. This guy is a mountain of a human. I mean, he's a beast. I would not want to upset him for any reason whatsoever. And then in the middle of this test, I basically dunked him in water and made him deal with class soaking wet. But he's like, "Oh man, that feels good, Craig. Thank you. I really needed that. I was warming up a little bit." You know, and that's just the attitude of somebody that is a dangerous individual. He knows that he has to stay calm in stressful situations, because he's been there, done that many, many times before. And so it's in survival, we talk about learning how to be comfortable in uncomfortable situations. That's what we have to do here. To keep our head, to think clearly, we have to, we have to be in a situation where we're taking in as much information and we can start to take the necessary steps, which is what a lot of people call being left of bang. And there's a book written on this subject called Left of Bang, but that's what we're talking about here. The situational awareness and these levels and understand baseline versus anomalies and all that stuff. That's being left of bang. So on a timeline, if you had left of bang and then the bang and then the right of bang, left of bang is being as totally aware as you possibly can, recognizing the tells that we should get into before we get done here. And then the bang happens, you're already starting to take the necessary steps to fix that situation. If we're not, if we're not doing all that stuff left of bang, then the bang happens. Now we're right of it. Now we're stressed. Mm-hmm. Now we're victims from the stress of it all and possibly the firearm. And so at that point, we're not having good sense-making. We're not making critical decisions very well. And in that situation, things happen very rapidly and very problematically so that we're not doing what we should be doing.
Well, and let's get into some of those tells, those alert signals, those what do we see that gives us concern and what do we do about it?
Well, there's a lot that goes into it for sure. And I don't want to keep saying, but we could talk about these issues for quite a bit too, but I lump them into about three different things, biometrics, kinesics, and proxemics. And these are just fancy words that mean tells, the things that we do that we cannot control, and our placement in the world is proxemics. Okay. So kinesics are this understanding of body language, which includes posture, how people gesture, their facial expressions. Facial expressions is its own animal in and of itself. Microfacial expressions is a lifetime study by itself. But in kinesics, you know, one of the big things is that when people get stressed, one of the first things that happens is that, and when I say stressed, if somebody's going to be an active shooter, unless they're some sort of sociopath or psychopath or whatever the proper term is, you all would probably understand that better than me because you'll understand it better than me, but whatever that person is, their body temperature is going to rise. And when your body temperature rises, even on a small level, the first place that feels that is the top of the head. And because of that, the pores open up to allow some of that heat out. And so you'll see people that are scratching their head or they're feeling the top of their head or something of that nature. That is somebody that could be, and I want to emphasize, could be somebody to pay attention to. If you're in code yellow and you see somebody that is an anomaly and they're also doing that, now we've got two marks. That doesn't mean we pull out a firearm and shoot them. That doesn't mean that at all. It doesn't mean we hit them right in the face with a bat. It just means that we're giving them our attention. We should focus our attention on them and then start to assess if anything else comes up and start to make the necessary adjustments to whatever it might be. So kinesics are basically tells, what most people call tells. Something else that comes up is people look over their shoulder if they feel apprehensive about what they're doing. If somebody, like if we're going back to that administrative assistance at the front door, if somebody's walking up to the front door and they've looked over their shoulder a couple of times, I'm not taking my eyes off of that person. Yep. If I'm that administrative assistant, I am not taking my eyes off of them. If I'm buzzing them in, I'm asking all the questions that I've been trained by my security staff to ask if something doesn't feel right about it. And because that is an indicator of someone that is not comfortable with what they're doing by looking over their shoulder. And again, let's be real clear. There's some people that just do that. That doesn't mean that we thump them.
Sure.
That doesn't mean we do anything, but at least I'm focusing my attention and not normalizing that situation to the point where, hey, I'm not paying attention to what's going on. So that's kinesics. Were you going to say something, Daisha? I'm sorry. Okay. So biometric. Well, let me say this. People that are well-trained can control their tells. People that pay attention to this sort of stuff know how to control their tells. Like for me, for example, y'all have heard this. For those that are listening, I have a really difficult time of not starting sentences with so. Some people's connector is and. Some people, I tend to connect things with so. So I just did it. I have to work hard on not doing that when I'm being interviewed like this, or when I'm on camera, or when I'm in front of a group speaking. If I put focused attention on it, I will not utilize that word so, which you all have just heard me do, because I just slowed down and stopped and paid attention to what I was doing, and I never said the word so. We can train ourselves to do that if we give it our undivided attention, so that we don't give away our tails.
Mm-hmm.
Now, biometrics is something entirely different. Biometrics are those things that happen to us that we really don't have as much control over. So biometrics are involuntary physiological responses to things, things like sweating, your pupils dilating. These are things that can signal that somebody is stressed or having, you know, maybe even deceptive or inappropriate behavior, something of that nature. You can see this in the pupils. You can see this because they've got sweat on their brow or something. And if I'm stressed, sometimes I just can't control that. And it just happens. It's this physiological response. No matter how hard I train, it's hard for me to stop those biometrics from happening, those physiological responses. And then proxemics, which is the third part of this, is basically how people respond in the environment or their placement with other people or with the environment that they're in, whether it's, you know, the space that they're in. So, for example, people that maybe if there's multiple people working together, one of those people is the leader. And typically that leader is the one that people will wait until they say or do something and then respond to it. You know, another way, and I like to say this because people will look for this when they're out in the restaurant the next time. This is how you can tell if a couple is getting along together really well or not. Is if you're looking at a table and there's a couple at the table and they're both in agreement with one another, they'll both have the same body language. Meaning if they're both leaning in, that means they're okay. If they both lean back at the same time, they might be having a disagreement at that time. But if one of them leans back, folds their arm, crosses their legs, and the other one is still leaning forward, they are not in agreement. They are having trouble. They are having issues. These are the types of things that when you study this subject that we all here are just scratching the surface on.
Yeah.
You can go in and look up those three words if you want to and do an in-depth study, biometrics, kinesics, and proxemics. You can start to see these things in the people that surround you all the time and start to read, okay, the way that person is coming in the door is not how, because I've paid attention to how people come in the door. That's not how people come in that door. If a delivery driver, you know, if there's a FedEx driver that's delivering to a hospital or whatever, the delivery drivers know where to deliver the stuff, whatever that stuff is. If somebody's coming to the wrong door, then that's worthy of my attention. I'm going to pay attention to that. Mm-hmm. And if I'm the person that's buzzing them in through the door, then I'm going to ask those questions again that my security staff has told me I should ask and do that sort of thing so I can at least take necessary steps left of bang before something occurs.
Well, and again, I want to call back on my experience working in security years ago, because the bulk of the job was people watching. And you pick up on certain indicators, body language and otherwise. And there was a woman I worked with for a long time named Shauna, and she was just outstanding when it came to picking up on the littlest things. And, you know, for example, a woman would come into the store and she would put her purse in the cart in a very certain specific way. And Sean would immediately key in on it. And what are you talking about? She's a regular woman shopper wouldn't put their purse that way. That doesn't make sense. She's up to no good. And sure, nice. Got me little green apples. We end up catching her stealing stuff, shoving stuff into that purse, you know? And like you said earlier, one of the things that I really want to stress to people when you start digging into these body language and other tells and indicators, one indicator or one tell is meaningless.
Yes.
You've got to have them in sequence. You have to have them in groups. You have to have them in bunches. One by itself doesn't tell anything. you have to group them together, and that's where you start reading the story. Okay. One of the things that we learned when it came to interviewing suspected employees who were suspected of theft, for example, one of the things we would do is, as we're speaking to them, we would start mirroring their body language. You know, you talked earlier about how you would have people, they both lean forward in the conversation, they both lean back in the conversation, things like that. We would start to do that. If the employee leaned back, we would lean back. If they leaned forward, we would lean forward. And at some point, they would start mirroring you. And that's when you knew, okay, we're able to communicate here a whole lot more effectively.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
You know, and it's one of those things that you don't think about until you're paying attention to it. Mm-hmm. And when you start paying attention to it, you can't unsee it.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it's man, the more I hang out with people that have to do this for a living, it's just those things come so natural to them, and I love hanging out with them. That's why I used to do ride-alongs with law enforcement officers all the time, because they would just, they'd be driving around. You see that dude, do a turn around, come back, and then that dude starts running. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, how did you know that that dude was doing something?
Yeah.
And I mean, I would literally ask that question, and, you know, this is where I got some of this knowledge that I'm trying to share with you all, is reading some of these things that they would see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, another big one that comes up is as far as proxemics is, or maybe even kinesics, it kind of goes both ways, is we tend to point our toes where our attention is. And so if I'm talking to you facing me, even if you're in front of me and my toes are off to the side and I'm facing that direction and I just kind of look over my shoulder to talk to you, my attention is somewhere else.
Yep.
And you'll see this in pre-event indicators that somebody's attention might be the getaway car or whatever it might be.
Sure.
They just keep looking back to make sure that their driver is still there. Mm-hmm. Why are they looking back? Why is their hand in their pocket as they look back? Most people, when they come up, both their hands are out of their pockets. Now we're looking at two things. Now we're adding a third in there, maybe a fourth. And now we're not going to let them in the door, or we might even buzz security, or we might be, if we are the security, we might be at least getting ourselves in a position where we can get concealment and cover and do what we need to do.
Yep. Yep.
All right. Well, Craig, I feel like we could have you on the show every week, and I think we should start making up excuses just to have Craig back as a guest. Any final thoughts before we let you go? And I mean, I know there's so much more we can cover, but we've done the basics. Maybe we have Craig back for an encore and we delve a little further into it.
But yeah, let me ask this question, because I thought maybe y'all had done Cooper's color code. Have y'all talked about the OODA loop? Because that's fundamental too.
What?
Have y'all talked about it? Okay, let's talk about that and then we'll exit. How's that sound?
I feel ashamed that I haven't covered these things yet.
Yeah, you let me down, bro. You let me down. What, Dacia? You need to, Dacia, Brian, you need to fix this dude.
The loop?
The OODA loop.
OODA loop.
OODA loop.
Right, so
either a 1960s novelty song or some Kentucky area cryptid that I've never heard of.
It actually sounds like something that they would have talked about on HR Puffin stuff, but you know.
Oh my gosh, man. All right, so the OODA loop for our listeners, and I know you all know this, and I appreciate you all letting me be the expert when you all could talk about this too. But the OODA loop is observe, orient, decide, and act. And that's basically the process that we go through when we're looking at any situation. And we observe it, we orient to it, we decide what we're going to do, and then we act upon it. And so if we need to defend ourselves against an active shooter, we're going through that OODA loop rather quickly. The beautiful thing is that person is doing that too. They have observed what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. They have oriented themselves to do it. They have decided, and now they're acting on it, or they're getting ready to act on it. If, and this is a big if, and this is what I was referring to earlier, if we can engage from close proximity, if we disrupt their OODA loop, they have to
Oh, we're muted. You got muted just like right at the end.
Oh, I'm not sure how that happened. Can't unmute guests. Their mic isn't connected.
Did you come unplugged?
Jim, can you text him and tell him he came unplugged?
So I think what Craig was going to say, and he, yes or no, is that if you can interrupt that attacker in the midst of their OODA loop, right before they actually begin the act, then you probably could save one is enough, but more people than not.
Basically, yeah. I mean, if you're able to disrupt their thought process, you're able to, how can I phrase this? This is why we have Craig on, so he can explain these things.
I know, right?
it's kind of like if you disrupt a computer program, you stop a computer program, it just stops and has to restart. Okay, the OODA loop is like that when you're dealing with an aggressor. If you can disrupt their OODA loop, it causes them to freeze up for a second, and they've got to re-engage. They've got to re-decide. They've got to reorient, re-decide, react. Yes. And that gives you a window where you can do something.
Yes, that's exactly right, Jim. You couldn't have said it any better. And for those that are listening, I'm sorry, my microphone messed up if you got a little break there from me. But no, Jim's, this is what I was saying earlier. These three people can handle this conversation really well too. But the OODA loop is exactly that. Let me tell a story. People love stories, right? Mm-hmm. This would be a great story to describe the OODA loop. I used to work for a cousin of mine that did home improvement. And one day we were working near the high school here in my hometown. And I'm standing out by the sidewalk, and I look down the sidewalk, and here comes this couple walking up the sidewalk, a young man and young woman, or young girl, out of the high school. And man, he is hammering her verbally. Like verbally, what I would consider verbal assault. And I've got a major problem with it, but he's a kid, so I can't put the hammer down on him either. You know, punch him, knock him out, choke him, whatever. That's not cool. As he gets closer, I just stare at him. And when he gets super close to me, he goes, what he says, what are you looking at? I'm not looking at anything, man. I've been sitting here putting windows in this house all day. And this old lady that we're putting the windows in for, she keeps feeding us this pink lemonade. You like pink lemonade? I love pink lemonade. I've been drinking probably 20 glasses of pink lemonade, and I've had to use the bathroom so many times a day. I keep going in her bushes. I went into her house. I've gone behind her tree, but she just keeps bringing out pink lemonade. I love pink lemonade, but there's so much pink lemonade. It's just been too much, and all I've had to do is use the bathroom over and over and over again. Do you want some pink lemonade? I'm sure if we asked her, she could give you some pink lemonade. So when I'm done, he puts his arm around her like he's going to protect her from me, and then they carry on. So what did I do? I interrupted his OODA loop. I got up in the middle of his OODA loop, completely obliterated it, put him on a different direction. Now, what happened after that, I don't know, obviously. But at the time, I really thought he was getting ready to get physical. And it was not a good solution for me to get physical with a 16-year-old kid. Yeah. That's not a good solution. And so,
even in Kentucky?
Yeah, not even in Kentucky, man. Gosh, Kentucky. Kentucky's the greatest place on earth, Jim. Be careful.
I know. Hey, I've been there.
But in all seriousness, that's me disrupting his OODA loop. That's exactly what I did.
Yep.
And we can do that. And Jim did a really good job sharing this. We can disrupt that OODA loop of that active shooter, get in the middle of it, and do everything we can to cancel Christmas, like I mentioned earlier. And then, yeah, we might be, as Dacia said, we might have saved 200 people. Who knows?
Yeah.
In that situation.
All right. Well, Craig, thank you so much. I'm sorry, Dacia. What's that?
No, I said it was a great story.
It was.
Yeah, thank you.
Great story. Great episode.
Dacia, do you like pink lemonade? Jim, do you like pink lemonade?
I know what Craig did for Christmas this year.
Where can folks find out more about Nature Reliance School?
Oh, naturereliance.org is my website. All my socials are on there. But that's the best way to hit me up, info@naturealliance.org. We have the YouTubes and the Instagrams and the Facebook and all that stuff. Awesome. All my books are on there as well. So yeah, love to have you join us at Nature Alliance School for any of the stuff that we do.
All right. And if Dacia and I pool our savings from the advertiser money for this show, can we send Jim to you? Can you set him right?
No, that's an impossibility. I've worked with Jim long enough to know that y'all don't have enough money for me to fix Jim. Jim.
You know, I have joked though that it's a good thing that Craig and I don't live within close proximity.
We would get nothing done, Jim.
We would just be sitting around talking all day.
No, we wouldn't get nothing done. Oh man.
I think that's 90% why I'm on this show.
To keep everybody straight.
To keep everybody in line.
Okay.
Fair enough.
I'm a bear enforcer. Keeps us in line.
Well, Craig, I really appreciate you coming on the show. You shared some wonderful information. I think we definitely like to have you back on a future show where we can dive in a little bit more on some of this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Love to. Thank you all for having me. And my goal always is to help people to be safer and have more fun in life. So good stuff. Thank you all for letting me be on.
All right. We appreciate it. Next week, folks, we are going to finally get around to answering your questions. It's a Q&A episode. If you've asked us something on social media or email, you want to tune in next week. In the meantime, Dacia, how's it going to be?
Everything is going to be okay.
Oh, you're right. We'll see you next week, folks.